now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Bob Luca. Bob and Betty Andreasen Luca were the subject of books written by Raymond E. Fowler, The Andreasen Affair, The Andreasen Affair Phase 2, and The Watchers. And Bob is going to talk a lot about what's happened since The Watchers and Watchers 2 has come out. He's going to share information about the deep black government military harassment that he and Betty had endured over the years. Not many people realize this, and it's a focal point of his new book. So without any further ado, Bob Luca, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Bob, this is truly an honor. Like I was saying before we got started, Betty's books and your involvement with Betty, which really was divinely inspired in my book as far as that goes, because if there was ever a couple that were put together for a specific meaningful purpose to get this kind of information out, it was you and Betty. And for those of us that are out there that are having these experiences, your story has been such an instrumental part of our lives, and I want to just thank you publicly here for everything you and Betty have done over the years.
Well, thank you so much. You know, we've always hoped that by coming forward and just really letting it out, what happened to us, that it will be helpful to other people, and that people should not be afraid to talk about these things. They're happening. There's no need to keep it all pent up inside or be afraid to discuss it because, you know, the government had years ago put this stupid thing on it where they either ridicule you or try to discredit you or try to intimidate you. The heck with that. Be honest, get it out. And the more people that can get this out, the better chance we have of getting disclosure once and for all. The government's not going to do it, that's for sure. They need a lot of pressure, and people can apply pressure in numbers.
Yes, because disclosure is us, we the people. We're the disclosure, and since we're not getting what we want out of the powers that be, then it's up to us to take the mantle. To help our listeners with the background, Bob, could you tell us a bit about your story and Betty's story, and, you know, moving forward up to the present day?
Sure. Well, really, this goes back to 1944. In 1944, Betty had her first experience. She was 7 years old. She was in a hut, little hut that her brothers had built for her, and she was waiting for her friend Dee Dee to come out, and I guess as little girls, they were playing with dolls. While she was waiting, what she thought was a bee came and buzzed around her head several times and then struck her in the forehead between the eyes, and she went down and apparently became unconscious for a short time. Well, it turned out it wasn't a bee. It was a small, what looked like a BB, but a white, the size of a BB, but it was actually a white light of something. And when she was put down by this thing, she heard a voice that said something about the wee little one is coming along fine or something of that nature. I can't tell you the exact words because she knows them. And of course, to me, it's still secondhand. And also in 1944, I was 5 years old. I was living with my mother, and I were living with my grandmother because my dad and all of my uncles were in overseas during World War II, and they were all in combat. So my uncles, before they left, they had built me a swing set out in the backyard, and I was sitting on the swing set one day, as children do, and I saw this bright light in the sky, and it was coming closer and closer. And even as a child, I knew it wasn't normal. It just didn't, you know, it didn't belong there. The thing approached and actually stopped in midair above and to the left of me, right over our Victory Garden. And everyone then had a Victory Garden during the war years, of course. And while I was sitting on the swings, a very thin beam of white light, about the thickness of a lead pencil, came and out of this thing struck me in the forehead. And at that time, I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I was just like stuck on the swings. And I felt in my body was almost like, well, for those who've experienced it, like if you drank too much caffeine and you feel like a little bit shaky, I felt like that. And this thing tipped to the side, and I could see what I described then as two little people in there, which today would be known as grays. And they relayed a message to me that they were doing something that in the future would be good for mankind, and that people that had seen them, and they said many people, would come together in the future and meet each other. And that was all that I could remember of this message, but they did make it very clear that I was not to tell anyone. And this never came out until years later, of course, when I underwent hypnosis. But there are a couple of things that backed that up, that gave me confirmation. One, became a big area in the Victory Garden where nothing would grow anymore. And fortunately, some of my cousins witnessed that, as well as my grandmother and my own mother. The second thing that happened was years later, after this came out under hypnosis, a psychic was brought in, and she's somebody that was well known. She'd worked with police departments on solving cases and finding bodies and things of that nature. She actually worked for the government for a time tracking Russian submarines. Well, she took my jackknife. I guess she did what's called psychometry. She took my jackknife, and she began to explain to me in great detail exactly what happened, right down to the thin beam of white light. And she talked about pipes and vines in the backyard. Well, afterwards, I thought to myself, well, that was pretty good, but there was no pipes and vines in that backyard. So, you know, she's off in that respect. And there was no chance that anyone had told her, because she was just brought in on the spur of the moment by police officer Larry Fawcett, who was a police lieutenant and an investigator in our case. Well, later on, I was talking to my mom, and she said, oh, yeah. She said, don't you remember your grandfather had pipe arbors and grapevines in the backyard? So she picked up things that I did not remember. So to me, this is, you know, pretty good confirmation. Well, as we moved on through time, 1967 rolled along. 1967, I'm a young man. I'm on my way to the beach on a bright, sunny day. And I got to a place known as the Trap Rock, where there was a rock quarry and there was a railroad spur that came in there where they hauled the crushed stone and whatnot out. As I'm driving by this place, I looked to my left and it was five men working on the railroad track, except nobody was working. They're all pointing up in the air. So, not pointing, I'm sorry, looking up in the air. So I glanced up to see what they were looking at, and I saw two huge, what today would be described as cigar-shaped craft. They were side by side. There was no way they could have been airplanes. They were flying, as I said, side by side. They were flying toward New Haven, Connecticut, from relative to where I was. They made no noise. They were bright, shiny, like almost like polished chrome in the sun. No wings, no tail, no engines. It looked like a flying fuselage. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. So I pulled my car over, and I'm looking at these things. And while I'm looking at them, two small disc-shaped craft objects dropped out of them, one from each one, right, dropped right out of the belly of them. And I thought, this was just blowing my mind at the time. This is 1967. One went off toward New Haven and the other one went in the opposite direction. So I had watched till they were out of sight, and then I resumed my trip to the beach. Well, I was in a very rural area. I got down the road, maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles, and all of a sudden, on the left, to my left, one was returning, and there was a big field, like a pasture, on the left-hand side of the road. This thing came and settled and stopped a few feet off the ground to the left of the highway, small road, actually. I looked at it. Now, mind you, I'm driving toward the beach. I looked at it. I saw a very brilliant flash of really red light, almost like a ruby laser, very brilliant red light. And all of a sudden, I was inside this thing with no... It just seemed like instantaneous. There were five beings, what we would consider grays today. And I was told to remove my clothing. And I got to be honest with you, I was scared at the time. I did notice it was cold, not cold, but cooler than the outside. And there was what appeared to be a mist on the floor. What they did, they took me and they put me on a table. They examined my skin, scraped my nails, moved my ankle joints. They took sperm from me, which I didn't talk about in earlier days. It was a little embarrassing. And they scanned me with, I can only describe it as a modern X-ray machine, but very thin. It came out of the ceiling. And it scanned my body back and forth from head to foot. When they were done with me, I was put back in my car, fully clothed, on my way to the beach. And I had no idea this had happened at the time. But when I got to the beach, which should have taken me 30 or 40 minutes, it was almost a total of 3 hours that were gone. And I had no idea. I was hungry. And I just shouldn't have taken that long to get to the beach. There was no traffic that day. Well, years later, after I met Betty, I was put in touch with the MUFON investigators. I underwent regressive hypnosis, and that's when that account came out. Now, also in 1967 is when Betty was home with her family, her seven children, and her mother and father. Well, we're visiting her. They saw a pulsating red light outside of the home. And her first thought was, well, maybe it was a fire truck or police or something like that. So her father ran down to the front window to look out. And before Betty knew it, five of these beings, very similar, almost exactly the same except for the uniforms, came right through the front door of her house. And she thought, well, Betty being a spiritual person thought, well, maybe there are some kind of angels. And while they were there, they had a trade of books. They gave Betty a very thin blue book, and they told her she could keep it for 10 days. And she, in turn, gave them a Bible. Now, what was interesting is the leader picked up the Bible and held it in his hand. He passed his hand over it and apparently made duplicates. And they were passed to the other beings. Interestingly enough, as they looked at it, they just passed their hand over it and the pages would flip by themselves. The book that they gave Betty was white, looked like just white pages, except there was somehow on these pages she got the impression of machinery, language. She was told to study the book for 10 days, and then they would take it back. Well, her daughter Becky came to her a couple days later and said she was having this dream of these funny people in the house, and it scared her. So Betty took her aside. She being the oldest, she explained that it really happened. It wasn't a dream, and she let Becky look at this book. When Becky touched the book, there appeared to be what, like glitter on her hands and whatnot from touching the book. And from that time on, Becky had been able to write the language of the beings. I don't know if you would call it spirit language or just alien language or whatever, but she could just write it freely, just as easily as I write in the English language. Now, probably because Betty showed her the book, it disappeared before the 10 days was actually up. But that's only part of it. Betty was taken out of the house by the beings, and their craft was on a slight embankment behind the house. Quasgar, which is what the leader's name was, that's what she was told, raised his hand, and the bottom of the craft became somewhat transparent, so she could see through it. And she was then taken into the craft, given an examination, and also shown how the craft operated. Now, what's interesting here, and I think the investigators missed it at the time because it was 1967, we all know that in the case of Betty and Barney Hill, Betty was given a star map that kind of verified that, well, she didn't just think this up. You know, someone had to give it to her, and it kind of gave more credibility to her case. Well, what they did with Betty, they showed her the propulsion system, which partly consisted of a huge, what you would look like a metal donut. And they told her that there was mercury circulating in this donut. Well, it didn't make much sense then, but today our military has the TR-3B and other models of it, which use liquid mercury circulating at a high speed, I think around 50,000 RPM. And that is an integral part of the craft propulsion system, because what they found, mercury rotating in a tube like that, reduces the effect of gravity by something like 89%. So here is kind of like a confirmation that, well, yeah, she was given something in 1967 that really wasn't known to us that much in 1967. The other thing that happened, when she was taken with them to different areas, she came back and under hypnosis, which was years later, she drew pictures of this face that she had seen on top of a huge pyramid. Turns out, if you take the face that she drew and put it right next to the face that was shown on Mars by the Viking orbiter, they are exactly the same. Now, she didn't know this in 1967. That's what 9 years before the orbiter ever went up to Mars. So again, this is a form of confirmation. Betty was also told she was chosen to show the world. And when she was told this, she was asked if she understood. And she said, no, I don't understand. I don't even know why I'm here. For years, both her and I wondered, well, what is this? What are you supposed to show the world? And we finally figured out, hey, it was the experience. Because in 1967, nobody was talking about this to this extent. And they wanted, apparently, to get it out to the public, to the people. And that's what I believe she was chosen for, is to break the ice and to get these stories out there and to show other people that if you had these experiences, don't be frightened, because you go through so much. You think at first that, did I imagine this? Am I going crazy? That you get angry? And it's really sad that back then people had these feelings and they couldn't talk. There was no one they could talk to get this stuff out. So I think what she did was just break the ice and say, okay, here it is. This is what happened. You know, you can believe it or not. And some people chose to believe it, and some people today still don't, mostly those in government that don't claim they don't know what's going on. But anyway, that's something else. But the thing is, I think the story coming out, as you said, I think it helped a lot of people, because she got letters from all over the world. And many people thanked her for having the nerve to put the story out there and show people what was going on. Well, now, okay, she's had experience in 44, so did I. She had one in 67, so did I. Now, comes 1977. Betty is in Florida, and she's working. I was working as a service manager for a car dealership in Connecticut. And I had this urge. A friend of mine came and asked me, he says, Bob, he said, I'm going to look out of state for work. He says, how about you and I go together? And I thought about it. I said, well, you know, I got a good job. I'm single. I get a new car every 3 months, good pay. And then a feeling came over me some way that I had to make this trip. So I went to my boss, the dealership owner, and I said, his name was Bob too. I said, Bob, I said, I want a month off. And so of course he said, no, he said, I can't give you a month off. He said, no way. Well, that was on Friday. I went home. I thought about it all weekend, and this urge was just very strong. I went in Monday. I said, Bob, I said, you can fire me. I can quit. I'm taking a month off. And thankfully, he gave in. Now, this was very unusual for me. I'm a pretty conscientious guy, and I was a hard worker. And for me to do this was quite unusual. Well, what ended up, my friend Eddie and I packed up the car, packed up a trailer, and we went down to the southern part of the country, went through Texas, California, Oregon. We were headed back along the northern tier of the country to Connecticut. We're in Idaho, if I remember right, and all of a sudden, we decide to go to Florida. Now, this is 6,000 miles maybe out of our way, round trip to go to Florida and from there and then back up to Connecticut. But anyway, we went. And when we got there, we pulled into the yard. My friend Eddie's sister-in-law lived in Pompano Beach. Well, we pulled in there and we stayed there, parked the trailer on their property. And the second night we were there, Eddie's sister-in-law started talking about this woman that she worked with that had had a UFO experience. Hmm. And I thought, wow, I'd love to talk to her, because I had only told my parents, my best friend, and my ex-wife, who did not believe or support me. So that's probably a good reason why she's an ex-wife. But anyway, I said, well, who is this woman? So Eddie's sister-in-law told me where she worked at this restaurant. His sister-in-law was a cook there, and Betty was working as a waitress. So I went down to see her, and I said, I'd like to talk to you. And unfortunately, Ray Fowler, the author of the books, the previous books, warned her, don't talk to reporters, because he was working on a book at that time. The first book was not out. Well, she thought I was a reporter, so she's not going to talk to me. So I tried everything I could, finally convinced her that I was not a reporter. I said, look, let me take you out for lunch tomorrow, and we can talk. So I finally got her out for lunch the next day. And I've been buying her lunch ever since that day. That's the way that worked out. But I mean, that's how we met. And it's just so unusual. I didn't have any plans of getting married again. And she didn't have any plans of hooking up with anyone either. It was the UFO phenomena directly that brought us together. And as I said, that was thousands of miles out of our way to go from Idaho to Florida and back to Connecticut. But once we got back to Connecticut, we started seeing each other on a regular basis. And of course, we got married. And then we moved into a home in Connecticut. And that's when funny things started to happen. First off, we didn't know if the house was haunted or if this is part of what goes along with the UFO phenomena. The house itself was a small Cape style house, was in good condition. We moved in. By then it was just Betty and I and the two girls, Bonnie and Cindy. Well, we'd hear sometimes there'd be footsteps. If we were downstairs, we'd hear footsteps upstairs. If we were upstairs, we'd hear footsteps downstairs. Then the girls started to see shadow people going through the house or whatnot. Cindy at one time, or Bonnie, I'm sorry, thought it was me in the kitchen. I was upstairs. Another occasion, I see this guy go down the stairs into the basement. Now, this house had no outside exit to the basement. So I say, hey, what's up with this? I go down to chase the guy down the stairs. I get down there, and there's nobody there. So I said, wow, this is kind of strange. And all the electrical stuff in the house would act up. The two girls had the neighbors over, the next door neighbors, and they're listening to music and whatnot. And all of a sudden, the lights start going off and on by themselves in the living room. And the neighbors' kids ran home. They left the house. So it just scared them. One night, Betty was in her nightgown. She was ready to go up to bed. We were downstairs, and the doorbell rang. I opened the doorbell, and there's no one there. It's just like somebody saying hello or whatever. No one there anywhere around the yard could be seen. And I was standing probably 4 feet from the door. It didn't take me but a half a second to open the door. Well, then things start getting really odd. One morning we came downstairs. The bedrooms were upstairs. We came downstairs, and in the kitchen, all of the crown molding, the molding between the wall and the ceiling, was all on the floor. The nails, the finishing nails, were still in the wall. And then we had a huge a spaghetti pot, a stainless steel pot with a rolled top. That pot was split right through the rolled part of the stainless steel, split apart. And our glasses that were in the cabinet had what looked like white squiggly marks on them, almost like they had been etched by someone or something. I think it had to take quite a bit of energy to do this, and yet we never heard a thing when we were upstairs in the bedroom. So finally, we after a year, we sold that house, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. This was in 1978, when the Andreessen Affair book was being done. Representatives from Prentice Hall Publishing came down to visit us at the house. And shortly thereafter, we started to notice that, gee, there's quite a bit of helicopter activity over here. Well, the helicopter flights got frequent enough and low enough that our next door neighbor, who was a city councilwoman, started to document them. At that time, they were all Huey UH-1s. They were low enough that they would vibrate the windows in the houses, and the next door neighbor thought, well, something was unusual here, and so did we. So I took photos of them, and I sent them to Ray Fowler. And he said, well, you're probably in a flight path. I said, well, I guess that's possible. Not a big problem. Well, we moved from that house to a home in Cheshire, Connecticut. While we were in Cheshire, maybe a week and a half, these helicopters started showing up over the house in Cheshire. So now, as a birthday present, I believe it was, Betty had bought me a good telephoto lens for my camera, and I had gotten some binoculars. So right away, you couldn't help but notice there was something unusual about these helicopters. Number one, they're all black. Even the side windows were tinted on many of them. Number two, they had no tail numbers, no ID numbers on them that were visible. So after this went on for quite a while, I called the FAA. I sent them photographs, date and time, approximate altitude, compass heading, and yet they couldn't tell me whose helicopters they were. In fact, they wrote me back and said, well, we don't see any ID numbers. We can't tell you who these belong to. And the whole reason I was writing to them in the first place is because they didn't have any ID numbers. And they had come over the house sometimes so low, I could have hit them with a stone or a baseball, not a problem. So they're violating a couple of laws right now. Number one, no ID. Number two, at low altitude, helicopters are supposed to maintain a 500-foot lateral distance from residences or houses, and they did not. They flew directly over the house numerous times. So I went further. I got in touch with the military, the FBI, the CIA. No one could identify these helicopters. Well, finally, I was talking to a guy at the FAA General Aviation District office in Boston, which covered our area. And he said, this sounds like a CIA operation to me. I'm thinking, what the heck would they, you know, why would they be involved? Well, I got a good picture of one of the helicopters that was circling over us, and I sent it to Bell Helicopter in Texas, where the Huey UH-1s are manufactured. And I have a letter back from Mr. Dick Tipton. He was the public relations person for Bell Helicopter. And I still have that letter to this day. He said, this helicopter is a, and he gave me the proper model. And then he said, it did not leave here in this configuration. This helicopter has been modified by the military for psychological warfare in Vietnam.
Whoa.
Okay, well, I still have the pictures and I still have the letters. Well, to add to that, it piqued somebody's interest because another fellow named Martino from the FAA office in Boston drove all the way down to Connecticut because he wanted to interview us personally. Unfortunately, he didn't tell us he was coming, and he came on a Saturday when we were out on his own time, but he did, fortunately, he left a note on our door. Well, sometime later, a couple of years later, actually, we were interviewed by Connecticut Magazine, and when we told them of all these things, they wanted to verify it. So they went to the FAA. They found Martinez, and he couldn't remember at the time. I said, that's kind of strange. The guy drives all the way down to our house, probably a couple hundred miles, 150, 200 miles, on a weekend, on his own time, and he can't remember. Well, I found out that's pretty much normal when it comes to government people that you talk to. The reason being, he was there on a Saturday, and Tuesday I had called the FAA office where he was, and they told me he had been transferred and they had no forwarding address. Okay. So that sounded a little strange, but what the heck. Well, what I didn't mention before was the first year the book was published, the IRS decided they were going to help us with our finances. So we get called in for an audit. And the following year, we get called in for an audit. And the following year, we get called in for an audit. Now, we're not making a ton of money. Betty was pretty much home at the time. I was an automotive technician. And, you know, you don't make $1 million on UFO books. That's for sure. Well, when Connecticut Magazine interviewed Mrs. Burnley, who was the IRS agent that did our audit, she couldn't remember either. So I thought that was rather strange, that people in government have very short memories when it comes to this stuff. But going back now to when we moved into this house, we had taken the two girls to school to get them started in school in Cheshire the day of the closing. We told them, when school ends, you come to the new house, and we should be there. The girls went to the house. And Betty and I were still at the closing. We had not yet had a key for that house. When the girls got there, someone was inside that claimed to be from the telephone company, which I believe, for reasons I'll bring up later, that they were probably installing a bug in the house. I didn't think a whole lot of it at the time because we hadn't, outside of the IRS and the helicopters, we didn't have a lot of harassment at that time. So I didn't pay that much attention. And today, of course, I wish I did. With the helicopters, we had them not only at our over our home. We're traveling in Massachusetts on Route 2, a very rural route. Two helicopters, both Hueys, come up out of a field and cross over and in front of our car at about 50-foot altitude. Now, you're in the military, you know this can be very intimidating, to say the least. They also showed up when we went to Florida on vacation. We had relatives there that said, oh, we knew you were in the area. We saw the helicopters. I said, great. Anywhere we went, the campground in New Hampshire, these things were just anywhere we went. Now, later on, after we had been in Cheshire for a couple years, there was a new entry, which was the Sikorsky Blackhawk. They were a fairly new helicopter at that time. That would have been around 82. So now they were alternating between the Hueys and the Sikorsky Blackhawks. Well, I got to looking at one day, and I wrote to Sikorsky, because Sikorsky is in Connecticut, wasn't that far from us as the crow flies. And they said that there are helicopters that are not registered, that don't have tail numbers, that haven't been certified, have a white ring completely around the body. Well, these didn't have any white ring. They didn't have anything. One day I'm up on the roof, and by this time I took my camera anywhere I went. I wanted that thing like American Express. So I was up on the roof putting shingles on, and here comes this Blackhawk, very low, right over the house. While I'm on the roof, I said, that's it. I got a couple pictures. I got off the roof. I went downstairs. I called the tower immediately at Sikorsky. And I asked him, I said, do you have a large black helicopter in this area? And they said, yes, we do. So I said, well, I want to file a complaint. So I did. And about 3 days later, I got a letter from Sikorsky. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself again. The tower told me it was Army, U.S. Army Blackhawk. So I filed a complaint. I got a letter from Sikorsky stating that they apologized for the low overflight of the Navy Blackhawk. Hmm. So I wrote him back. I said, wait a minute. You guys told me it was an Army helicopter. And I got these letters, too. Well, they said it was an Army helicopter being certified or test flown by the Navy. I didn't buy that. I don't think the Navy okays equipment for the Army, as far as I know. I mean, I haven't been in the military, so I'm not sure, but it just didn't sound right. Well, anyway, we finally decided, well, if they're going to keep doing this, we'll have a little fun with them. So I had a friend that was in the military, and he made me an exact replica, full size, of a surface-to-air missile. And the helicopters almost always approach the house from the north. And we had a cement patio out in back of the house, which is in the south. So I says, well, let's wait a while and we'll see what happens. Well, sure enough, a couple of days later, you hear the familiar, you know yourself, a Blackhawk, not a Blackhawk, a Huey is hard to miss because it has a very distinctive rotor sound.
Yes.
So we heard the thing coming from the north. We ran out back. We set up this missile on a cement pad. And Betty and I are standing there watching. Well, I knew what you could see as you flew over our house because I had was taking flying lessons and I had flown over the house a number of times myself. So I knew exactly what he would see and when he would see it. Well, the guy comes over the roof, clears it by enough so he can see it, and that helicopter made a very sharp, evasive move. The bottom pitched up toward us. I thought the blades were going to flex right off the thing, and away he made a sharp turn away from the house. And I told Betty, I says, you know, I bet you this guy's headed back to where he came from, and he could get himself a shower and probably a change of shorts at the same time.
That's beautiful.
They must have wondered, you know, where did that happen? How did he get his hands on that? But it was a fake. I mean, I would never do anything to these guys because they're just following orders. You know, as much as it was irritating, I understood they were just doing what they were told to do. Also, it was bad enough that they're flying over. These guys are taking pictures. Betty's in a store one day getting wallpaper for the house, and one of these helicopters comes over Huey, and you know they get big doors on the side. The doors are open. The guy's sitting in it with his feet on a rail, and he's taking pictures. And Betty is right out in the front of the glass here, and a guy is going by taking pictures. So we thought, well, maybe it's just a once-in-a-while thing, you know. Well, seems they were taking a lot more pictures. We're in Florida on vacation, and we're in a laundromat, and this guy comes running in, gets out of his car, comes running in, snaps a couple quick pictures, jumps back in his car. So I run out after the guy, and Betty goes over to the manager. We were the only ones in there. And she says, Betty says, well, is this place for sale? Are you advertising it or something? And the manager said, no. She says, I don't know why anyone's taking pictures. Well, the guy got almost out of the yard, and I got the license plate. And I gave it to Larry Fawcett, the police officer, and we got back. And when he ran it through their computers, it comes back as unissued. Now, this happened not only then, but while we were being surveilled by the helicopters, we were also being surveilled on the ground by cars that would follow us wherever. A couple of times, because of my background, and well, this is in the book. When I was a young fellow, I was always interested in technology, mechanics, and things like that. So I built very fast cars. In fact, all through high school, I'd never been beaten. Racing was just my thing back then. So I always had one eye open for the police and the other eye open for whoever I was racing with. Well, this paid off because I picked these guys up fairly easily. And I believe they were FBI, probably entry-level people. They didn't seem real good at what they were doing, because on occasion, more than one occasion, I got behind the cars that were following us, got the license plates, again, turned them over to Larry Fawcett, the police officer, and when they run through the computers, they came back unissued. So I'm pretty sure this was the FBI, because they had us under surveillance from about 1980 until 2000, if I remember correctly, when we had left Connecticut and moved to Florida. We purchased a condo in this Century Village in West Palm Beach. And as we got in there, this car was tailing us. And you have to get through a guard gate to get in there. It's private. So I went around the block, approached the car so we were facing it. And Florida's warm. The windows were open. And the woman in the car is speaking to someone. There's nobody in her car. And she's saying, they're here, they're here. So I said, well, pretty much looks like we're going to be followed down here as well. And another time, Betty and I left. Neither one of us likes real cold weather. So about 2 o'clock in the morning, we went out, hooked up our camp trailer, which was at a friend's house who was kind enough to let us leave it there. We hooked up the camp trailer, and off we went to Florida and never told anyone where we were. This was on I think about 2 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Well, Tuesday or Wednesday, two FBI agents with photo ID show up at my job, and they question my coworkers and my supervisor. They want to know where I was. Well, nobody could tell them because I didn't tell anyone at work. So here, supposedly at this time, no one knows where we are. We're driving along in Florida, and we decided, well, here's a nice place to stop. It was near Cape Canaveral, and we pulled into a KOA campground. We were there for a couple hours, and a woman from the office came down and told Betty, she says, there's a call for you from your son.
Yeah.
Well, this is impossible. Her sons didn't know where we were, and we just decided on the spur of the moment that we were going to go into this campground. So I don't know the technology they had back then, but they knew at all times where we were and what we were doing. And I'm going to be a little more specific now. We started doing some private lectures in Connecticut. people that were really had an interest, maybe didn't want to go to the public lectures for whatever reason, maybe because they're of their professional or whatever. So the first one was a psychologist in Connecticut. We were at her home, and it was a small group, 15, 20 people maybe. Betty had just finished her talk, and I started talking about the helicopters. No sooner did I start talking, and here is the familiar noise of a Huey UH-1. Now, it's raining, it's windy, yet this thing came in, circled the house, rattled the windows, all the people saw it. And I thought, boy, that is coincidence, because I had just started to talk about the helicopters. A few weeks later, we were doing a lecture like that at a dentist's home in New Britain, Connecticut. Betty had finished her talk. I started to speak. I started to talk about the helicopters. All of a sudden, we hear the rotor blades. Another Huey. This is in a different town with different people. Okay, twice is no coincidence. About a month later, we're doing a lecture for a contractor in, I believe it was Meriden, Connecticut, Meriden or Westfield, Connecticut. Same exact thing. Somehow, they knew right when I started to talk about these helicopters, that's when they'd show up. So it's no coincidence. And it got even, sometimes it was funny. Another time we were vacationing in Florida, and we're at a beautiful campground called Fort Christmas. It's right off Route 50, off of 95 going west. Beautiful place. A lot of pine trees, nice lots. We pulled in there, and our trailer was parked right in a clearing. The trailer was backed up just about to the clearing, to the wood line. And I got out of the car, and this helicopter, not a Huey, but it was a small, an observation helicopter, you know, a big bubble in the front, two passenger. It stops right over the clearing, and there's a guy in there with a camera, and he's taking our picture. So I quick went in the car. I got my camera, and I got two pictures of that fella while he was taking pictures of us. So, and, you know, it's just weird the way these things happen. But it was just so obvious. They didn't try to cover it up. They didn't try to do anything really to hide the fact that we were being harassed. It was the same with the IRS. A couple of people told me, well, you know, it's not necessarily that you're being punished for anything. I said, baloney. I was at one of the hearings, the audits. I was told they would not take my canceled checks as proof of payment for sewer and water taxes. I had to go to the city, get signed statements. I had to go to the bank where we had savings accounts. I had to go to the bank where we had a mortgage. I had to get signed statements from all these people to turn into the IRS. Now, if this isn't harassment, you know, I don't know what is. But I also enjoyed this in part because one of the audits, they asked me to produce documents that were more than 7 years old. And I knew I didn't have to do that. So I told her right out. I said, no. I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I don't have to give you those. And the guy said, well, he says, you know, he said, we can audit your ex-wife and get these. So I looked at him. My ex-wife and I didn't get along. I said, well, you better get busy then, because you're not getting them from me. So I guess I got her audited, which gave me a little bit of satisfaction. But anyway, that's how constant. I mean, it was just so obvious. There was a friend at work, a guy I worked with, that was a nice enough guy. I said, look, can you mail some stuff for me? Because our mail was being opened, especially anything we got from out of the country was opened. And I went and I complained to the postmaster, and she told me, she said, this is done by the postal inspectors and there's nothing I can do about it. So I told this guy at work, and he's very sympathetic. And when I had stuff I want to mail out to people regarding the phenomenon and whatnot, he'd mail them for me. Well, the end of that year, he got audited. So,
jeez.
God only knows how wide the circle spreads to your friends, coworkers. I mean, you know, where does it end? But it was just an endless stream of harassment. The telephone was tapped. Now, as far as the telephone, I have an excellent witness, which is a police lieutenant, because somebody broke into our call right after. I had just hung up from Larry, and he heard someone on the line. And they asked specifically if they got it on tape. Now, the interesting thing is back then, they didn't have the technology they do today, so they used to tap the line directly. What I did, I tapped my own phone. I cut into it right in the garage where the lines came into the house. So my recorder would start automatically every time I picked up the phone, and it would shut off whenever somebody called me when they hung up. If I hung up first, it would keep recording until the person calling hung up. And this came in handy because we got threats from time to time. One evening, I get a call, and it went something like this. The phone rings. I pick it up, and the guy says, "Is this Robert Luca?" I said, "Yes." He said, "We're coming to your house to beat your," I'll be polite, "beat your butt," and so on and so forth. So I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, I hope you got the right address. You got a pencil?" And the guy said, "Yeah, I got a pencil." So I told him where to put it. And then I hung up the phone. Well, my recorder was still running, and when I played it back later, I can only describe this guy's voice as a comical moose-like voice. He says to whoever was with him, he says, "He told me to stick to the pencil," and you know what the rest is. So, I figured it's probably a hoax, like so many were, but I loaded my 12-gauge and kept it with me for the night. And if somebody comes through that door, they're going to leave a lot quicker than they come in.
Yeah.
And we did receive other threats that were, well, not so veiled. You know who Dr. Alan Hynek was?
Yes, J. Alan Hynek.
Okay. Yeah. We were doing a lecture at MIT in Massachusetts. And during a break in a lecture, he came running over quick to Betty. He never said, "Hello, hi, how are you," anything like that. He said, "Leave the military out of this and stick to philosophy," and walked away. So he was giving her a clue to tell me to stop doing what I was doing, because I was after everyone from the Pentagon, the Air Force, OSI. I was filing on everyone. I was calling the Pentagon. I was getting in everybody's hair because I wanted answers, and I was tired of getting the runaround. Well, a year after that, we were at a lecture in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was during a break. And this guy approached me real quick, and when I looked at the guy, the first thing that entered my mind, I said, "Military." The guy had a buzz cut haircut. He was about in his mid-30s. I noticed his shirt was buttoned right straight down, exactly in line with his belt. His pants were neatly creased, and his shoes were black and shiny. So I thought to myself, well, this guy's got to be military. He just had that look. Oh, and his posture, very erect. And he said, "Look," he said, "the only reason we're sending the helicopters is so we don't have to hurt you." And I said, "Well, thank you so much." And he turned and away he went. So that gives you the idea that, yeah, somebody's not happy with what you're doing. Another occasion, we're flying out to Chicago, and it's Betty and myself and police officer Fawcett. We were promoting the book. We were to do some TV shows and stuff out in the Chicago area. Well, I get up to the desk at the airport, and the guy says, "Oh," he says, "Mr. Luca's already boarded the plane." I said, "No, he didn't." So I gave him my name. I thought maybe it was somebody else, you know, another person with the same name. And I said, "No, my name is Robert Luca. I live in Cheshire, Connecticut." And he says, "Yeah, he's already boarded the plane." So I said, "Great." Well, Larry Fawcett got there finally, and he came over to us and verified I was who I was and whatnot, and Betty and I got on the plane. No one was in my seat. But this is another way I think they try to keep you on edge. They want you to worry or be afraid or be nervous. And it just didn't work. I thought it was foolish. It just, you know, so what? So somebody said they're on the plane already and they're me. Well, They're not me, so I'm not going to worry about it. What I did worry about is while we were making a flight, the right-hand wing of the airplane was dripping what I thought was hydraulic fluid out of it. And I don't like to fly. I mean, I'll fly an airplane myself. That's okay. I'm in control. But commercial flying, nah, I don't like it. All the while we're going out there, I'm watching these, this oil drip off the trailing edge of the wing and wondering, oh, is it hydraulic fluid? Is it for the flaps? Is it for the brakes? That made me nervous, I'll clue you. But that's all part of the game. We had to fly to go to do the shows and whatnot. Fortunately, when we went out to California, Prentice Hall, the publishers, were sympathetic, and they got us a sleeper car. I said, great, that's terrific. So we took the train out to California, and on the way, the lights went out only in one car. That was the car we were in. Now, why, if it's coincidence or not, who knows? Now, let's get into another area. Let's start with the government in different ways. Betty and I have lived in several homes since we've been married. Four of the homes have been broken into. One place in Connecticut, we were going out to California to do a lecture, and the car broke down. We never made it to the lecture. We got back, and I found that we were living in a 30-foot camp trailer then, because I was working in Connecticut in the summer and Florida in the winter. We come back, and it's all wrapped with rope. And a neighbor came over. He said, well, somebody broke into your trailer while we were gone. I said, oh, great. The only thing that was taken was two drawings of the inside of the craft that Betty had drawn. Now, there was firearms, computers, cameras, jewelry. None of that was touched. The only thing taken was the drawings that Betty had made of the inside of the craft. So I had to get a hold of the state police because we were in a rural area. The police officer came up. I told him we were heavily involved in the UFO phenomena, and he took down all the information. He looked around. I guess he went and talked to neighbors and people in the area, and he said, well, check back with me in a week or so, and he says, if I find out anything, he said, I will tell you. So I thought, great. Well, a week goes by. I go back down to the trooper's office, and there's another guy there. And I said, oh, I talked to Trooper so-and-so about the break-in in my trailer. He said, well, he's been transferred.
Huh.
Yeah. Where is he? I don't know. So, see, that is another thing that runs with government when you're trying to track somebody. Somebody, apparently they moved this police officer out of there to another area. Another home, in the one in Cheshire, Connecticut, we're in bed. Late at night, well, 12, 1 o'clock, I don't remember exactly. I'd have to look in the book because all this is written down. But I heard two men talking in our kitchen. And I said, wait a minute, something's wrong here. And at that time, we had a big Belgian Shepherd. And he would bark when anybody came to the door. He didn't. He just laid there. And I looked over. He used to sleep at the bottom of the bed on the floor. And I looked over, and the dog got up, and as he did, his front paws slid out from under him, and his face went right flat down on the floor. So I said, wow, this isn't good. So I reached in the nightstand where I kept the 38, and I was going to go confront whoever was there. Didn't happen. Next thing I know, it's morning, and I have got a killer headache. Excuse me. Betty got up. She says, oh, I have a terrible headache this morning. So I said, what the heck is going on here? Well, we went to our respective jobs. She was working on the city phone directory, and I was working as a technician at the time. We came home at night, and Betty said, boy, she said, my left arm has been hurting me all day. And I said, well, that's odd. I said, my right arm has been hurting me all day. Now, I'm left-handed. Betty's right-handed. So we took off our shirts, and right about in the spot where you would get a vaccination, There was a black and blue mark on both of us, about a quarter, an inch and a quarter in diameter, with a puncture mark in the very center.
Uh-huh.
So I figured, well, somebody, they must have sprayed something in the house first to put us out and then injected us with something to keep us out. So I called the family doctor and asked him if anything would show up in a blood test. He said, no, it was already too late, that nothing would show up. But, I mean, that's the extremes that they had gone through. Because I'll tell you, government agent or not, if I'd have caught those people, I would have shot them. I that's just how angry I get at this stuff. And as I told you off the air, the way we were treated was the same way that the government treated the mafia crime bosses when they were trying to get them. We had the surveillance. We had the telephone tap. We were followed wherever we went in the cars and God knows what else. But it gets even deeper than this. A friend, and I can't say a name here because he was pretty well up there in government, happened to be at a CIA meeting. And he came to the house sometime out later, and he said, I want to talk to you. And he wouldn't talk to me in the house. I found this very interesting. We had to go out in the yard. And he said, he told me that he was at this meeting, and he said, these people, the CIA, he said, they're talking about you down there. And he wouldn't be specific, but he just more or less said, keep your eyes open. So, you know, I'm wondering how many agencies are involved. How much taxpayer money has been wasted on this foolishness when if they had just come to us and said, tell us what you saw or what you experienced or whatever, we would have done it. No problem. You know, I like our country. If this UFO technology that's going to benefit us, I'd love for us to have it. But unfortunately, the way they did things, it just ticked me off to the point where now I don't think I'd give them anything. And I can't help it. That's just the way I feel. And I don't think many people will blame me for feeling like that.
Yeah, especially after what you went through. And some of the stories that you're telling, Bob, they bring back memories of when I went through similar things. And you know, I've talked about it in the past. It's like, it's very disillusioning because, you know, like I said, you know, off the air, I'm a recovering Republican. I used to be a big-time flag waver and everything. And used to work for Naval Air Forces, and then when this deep black apparatus kicks in and you're on the receiving end of their harassment, it's quite disillusioning to say the least, because here you are, all your life, you were just fed a steady stream of propaganda, flag waver, and then the only thing that changed, Bob, as you know, is you start having these experiences, you start telling people about them, suddenly it's like you're like public enemy number one, but it's all done sub rosa, well, sometimes not, like in the overt examples of the helicopters. And I've gone through situations where they also overtly did things, and I do believe that you're right, it's meant to instill paranoia in us. Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment, Bob. Thank you so much for sharing what you have. And we're just getting started. And for our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.